You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Home run.
You are listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. If you have any thoughts, any questions, any comments, we'd love to hear it. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks for tuning in. And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. What a week it's been, really. Honestly, while we were focused on Donald Trump being laughed at the UN, the political theater around the Kavanaugh confirmation hearing, Rosenstein's employment status, trade wars, Russian hacking, Bill Cosby sentenced to 3 to 10 years in prison, and really the continued assault on women who have had the audacity to speak out. And that was just the past week. What we've also seen is legislators across the country carrying out the American Legislative Exchange Council's extreme anti-worker agenda. And interestingly enough, also this week, ALEC held its big 45th annual gala extravaganza at the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C. Pander much? And while they were partying, the legislators in Pennsylvania, where I live, were pushing the anti-worker poison in the form of multiple bills designed to pay construction workers less by attacking prevailing wage again, pushing preemption laws, making it illegal for communities to require employers to provide sick time or adopt equal pay provisions. Also, a bill to allow employers to ask their employees to sign away their workers' compensation rights. Also, another bill that would outlaw the state from allowing employees to pay their union dues via paycheck deductions. I guess United Way, you're next. Also, a bill that would greatly expand the union resignation window. Another ALEC beauty. And the thing is none of these pieces of legislation are going to make workers' lives any better. None of this makes work safer. None of this increases wages, doesn't create better working conditions, and honestly, they're not supposed to. It's really about silencing workers' voices and swinging that pendulum further in the favor of corporate interests over the interests of workers and their families. And it's interesting to me, you know, the preemption laws are one of those, you know, I get the anti-worker stuff, you know, hold down wages, steal benefits, destroy retirement, destroy opportunity. I get that coming from Republicans. What I don't get is the preemption, because they tell us that they're the party of smaller, less intrusive government, of local government. Get big government out of our lives. And yet here they are pushing a piece of legislation that would tell communities, no, you can't pass minimum wage laws. You can't pass paid sick laws. You can't pass equal pay laws. You can't pass anything without us up here at the state level telling you what to do. Now, I'm in favor of the state making conditions better, raising the floor up, saying, no, we want more communities where employers are forced to pay sick leave or higher minimum wage or equal pay or have safer working conditions. For me, you would expect that. But from a Republican, pushing these kind of poison laws kind of goes against the ideology, unless you understand it, as I do. It's about destroying working conditions in this country and really pushing more people into desperation. And you go, Rick, that sounds hyperbolic. 40 years of a record of destroying the working class of this country. It is that simple to me. And when I look at the assaults on, you know, prevailing wage, on minimum wage, on all of this stuff, you can only come to that conclusion that these are people who so hate work that they value, you know, the people who are, you know, the hard day's work to them is moving money from the right pocket to the left. And the person who's out there, you know, with the shovel digging a ditch, or the person on the road crew, or the person swinging a hammer building a house, or driving a truck, or climbing the phone pole to make sure the wires are right, those people don't matter. We're going to push policy, I guess, is the theory, push policy to make their lives much more difficult. And it's not just on the state level here in Pennsylvania. It's all across this country, and it's on the federal level as well. This kind of anti-worker fervor that the Republicans have internalized. You know, I remember a time when Republicans actually stood up for workers. I remember a time when there were actually some pro-union Republicans who believed that, you know, a fair day's work should come with a fair day's pay. Yet what have we seen for the last, well, couple of decades? An assault on the working class of this country. An attempt to silence the voices of workers and their families. And it just doesn't stop, you know, there at the workplace. You know, it also happens to our kids. You know, also in Pennsylvania. And this just blew my mind. There's a guy named Will Tallman. He's been a state representative for, you know, several years from Adams County, which is, you know, a small county in the center of the state. A very rural area. He actually sent out a memo to the 203 members of the state house looking for support for a bill he calls the Teacher's Code of Ethics. the Teacher's Code of Ethics. So not only is this about silencing teachers, it's about actually silencing students as well. Now, in the memo, Will Tallman said that his bill would prohibit public school teachers from endorsing, supporting, or opposing candidates or incumbents for local, state, or federal offices. Can't do it in the classroom. No! On-the-job teachers could not discuss enacted or pending legislation, regulations, executive orders, or court cases involving any level or branch of government. Nothing. Can't talk about it. Shh. They can't talk about activities that hamper or impede law enforcement actions or military recruiters on campus. Now that, to me, that little caveat thrown in there, as someone who has children in the public schools, as someone who understands the law is already in place that gives military recruiters my kids' phone number and address and access to all of their records for the purpose, the express purpose of convincing them that they need to join the military. Now, if you want your kids to join the military, that's great. If you go into it with your eyes open, fantastic. But are you okay with them having all of your kids' information and going around you? Are you okay with that? I'm not. And I actually learned about this from a teacher who said, that's the law. We have to give them all of this information. Are you okay with silencing a teacher's ability to say, hey, look, you know, parents, you know, hey, kids, you know, this might be coming. You might be getting a phone call from a military recruiter. Will says, well, we're going to hush those teachers up. In his memo, he says, quote, our K-12 school teachers should not be using their classroom time spent on political or ideological indoctrination. He goes on in the memo saying, doing so takes time away from instruction in the academic foundation subjects of mathematics, science, English, history, and civics. Yes, civics. And prevents our students from receiving a high-quality public education for careers in the global high-tech economy. But understand, he's perfectly okay with using the Bible as a science book. Now understand, this has no chance of becoming law. This is Will Tallman's swan song. This is what he has spent a lifetime of public service dreaming up. This is his swan song. This is the legacy he wants to leave. He claims that any teacher who would break the law would be suspended, lose their state license to teach in that state. He also claims that there are four states across the country who have enacted similar legislation, although he was unable to choose even one of the four. Maybe going back to school and learning a little bit about doing research before you put something out would be a good thing. Now, I was thinking about this in my life going back to school and, you know, thinking about, you know, when I was a kid in school, I don't remember Donna Stevens in math class ever saying, okay, 2 + 7 is, those Republicans are horrible. I don't remember that. I don't remember, you know, my science teacher, you know, going, okay, we have AU is gold, you know, H2O is water, and GOP is horrible. I missed that. I could have missed the day. I missed a little bit of school as a kid, but I don't think so. Now, I do remember talking about politics in government class. I remember, you know, James DeSillo, my teacher back then, you know, talking about politics. And we knew he was a Republican and a conservative one. In fact, he actually was the first person to lay out the Paul Weyrich, we don't want everyone to vote line to us in class. Now, he did it in a very kind of facetious way, kind of a, hey, you know, don't be stupid way. But, you know, there are a couple of things I still remember from, you know, 100 years ago in his class where he was actually right. He was insightful, but he was very open and honest about being a fairly conservative Republican. He was very clear about, you know, when you turn 18, don't bother voting. Stay away from the polls. You don't know anything yet. This way, my vote is much stronger. That was one of his lines. And also, you know, there was the other one. You know, someone had asked, you know, hey, you're a Republican. How do you decide which side of this aisle you're on? And he gave what I thought was probably one of the most cogent arguments about where the parties are. He said, look, you know, the Democrats are the party of the very poor, and the Republicans are the party of the very rich. And you in the middle, you got to figure out which ones you want to pay for. Are you closer to being rich or closer to being poor? And I thought it was an interesting way of thinking about it. Now, he did go on to say, you know, that's very simplistic and, you know, there's a whole bunch of nuance and policy. And he was very thoughtful and detailed in his political thought, which I really credit for the way I think about politics and the way I think about how things are framed and how they're put right out in front of us. Because, again, he was a conservative Republican and was very open and honest about his positions. And this was during the Reagan years where, you know, I was not a Reagan supporter. But here again, it's what scares me is this kind of political silencing, this kind of hit job to where we can't talk about this stuff. We can only shout at each other. We can only scream platitudes past one another. We can't have actual debate. In school is the perfect place. When you're young and you have ideas and debate and learning how to debate should be something we should be pursuing and pushing. A piece of legislation saying, no, we actually want debate in government and civics classes. We want kids taking more government courses, more civics courses, more thinking courses. You know, I remember a teacher who was the most popular teacher in school. His name was Ron Zutti. By far the most popular teacher in school, history teacher, taught this great elective course called American Life Today. Still remember it, you know, 30 some odd years later. He, at the moment we took the class, it was all about the political world in which we lived. It was all about how things were framed, how what we were seeing on TV was presented, how politicians looked at issues and how things were. And it made us aware of what was going on around us. This kind of education is imperative. It's imperative for a citizen's democracy. It's imperative for this wonderful experiment of self-governance. We have to have the insight, the ability to evaluate, the ability to debate and express our views. We have to be able to hold our, well, political leaders accountable when they're spewing BS. We have to be able to do that. Sadly, what's gone on in this country is we've gotten into our camps and we just throw bombs at each other. And it's all about my team winning. And the Kavanaugh thing is right there front and center, as is the Rosenstein thing. You know, it comes down to which team are you on? And I like to believe, because of those people that I had the privilege of sitting in their classroom and hearing their political views and hearing how they evaluate things and guiding us to think about things differently, that I'm better for that. I'm better for the political discourse that we were able to have, even though I was just a young snot kid. It gave me the ability to think about things and say, well, hold on, step back. Maybe we should not just have teachers doing this in schools. Maybe we should be holding continuing education classes for every voter and every citizen in this country. Maybe that would be a very good piece of legislation and a legacy that I'd get on board with you on. But this idea of silencing teachers, ridiculous, nonsensical, and, well, expected from the Republicans. Just my thought. I'd love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Again, you know, looking at how things are framed, looking at how things are presented to us. When we come back for break, Josh Bivens is going to be here to share some thoughts on the frame that, well, tax cuts create jobs. We're going to get rivers of gold and honey out of the latest tax cut hoax and all of the myths that we've been sold, well, since the Reagan era forward. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. So we've all heard reports about how the Republican pushed Tax Cuts and Job Act of 2017 has been this major success. It's been everywhere. How it was going to raise wages, it was going to afford workers huge bonuses. We were going to see these, in fact, lots of reports of big bonuses. And I said from the very beginning, what we were witnessing at that moment was really a well thought out PR campaign by the tax cut crowd to reinforce that myth that tax cuts will actually benefit the working class. You know, tax cuts for the 1%, you know, the millionaires and billionaires, if we make them richer, somehow it will trickle down to the rest of us. Reality, they don't. And here to share some light on and shed some light on the great tax cut hoax of 2017 is Josh Bivens. Josh is the director of research over at the highly respected Economic Policy Institute. Josh, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, we were told every worker was going to get $4,000. You remember back in October of 2017, you know, Trump in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, in front of the big giant truck said that his Council of Economic Advisors estimated $4,000 in pay increases for every American household. Has that happened?
So it definitely hasn't happened. We know a couple things. We know one, you know, that the even if you believed sort of the textbook argument for why cutting corporations taxes would eventually boost workers' wages, that's a process that's going to take time. My guess is it'll never happen for reasons we can go into, but even the big defenders of the tax code will say, yeah, that dynamic will take a while. But, you know, it was 2017. The tax cut hadn't even passed into law. They needed to brag about something. And so they just started seizing on any random bonus that a company gave any worker in that year and said, oh, look, it's a down payment on the wage increase you're getting from tax cuts. But bonuses happen every year. They happen before the tax cut. They happen regardless. So I think I think you just saw this PR campaign to grab any year-end bonus that any company gave and say it was because of the tax cut. And it was always preposterous. But now we know we have some data showing just how preposterous it was.
Yeah, and I would argue that even a couple of places that may not have given the $250 that they had, we had seen press releases on, did it for purely political reasons. Because look, they got a massive windfall. I mean, you're talking huge amounts of money in their pocket, and it had to look like they were at least willing, you know, to share a little bit, even just a tiny bit.
No, I think that's totally right. So on the one hand, it's the administration who wants a PR win, but it's not like the corporate class generally was not on board this tax cut and didn't want to help them get that PR win. So I think you had tons of corporations who, you know, give bonuses every year at the end of the year. And magically in 2017, they said, this one is because of the tax cut. The one we gave last year that was like the exact same size, who knows why that happened, but this one was because of the tax cut. And then you're right. Some may have even decided to throw some pennies at their workers as a down payment on getting the tax cut through Congress, because like you say, the benefits to the equity holders, the capital owners, the people who run the corporation are just utterly mammoth.
But here's the thing. You know what those bonuses weren't? They weren't wage increases. You know, at the end of the day, a bonus is great. You know, a little one-time, you know, little bit in your pocket is not a bad thing. But at the end of the day, it's not a sustained wage increase for a career.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, what you want, for the reason you just said, you want an increase in salary that sticks for the rest of your career and adds up. Bonuses are great. They're sort of a pale imitation of a wage increase. But now we even know data has come out on what happened in 2018. The bonuses didn't even really happen. Like if you compare bonuses pre and post tax cut, they just did not budge. Basically 38%, 39% of American workers get a bonus every year. That was the same in 2016, 2017, and 2018. There's no big boost because of the tax cut. And if you look at the total amount of bonuses given in the first quarter of 2018 after the tax cut relative to before the tax cut, you're talking about an increase of like 3 cents, which is basically inflation. So even the bonuses, pale imitation of wage increases, but they didn't even get spurred because of the tax cut.
Yeah, but at the end of this, we hear Donald Trump all the time, you know, talking about how wonderful the economy, the best economy ever, you know, the best stock market ever, the best everything ever. And yet we've seen wages actually not just stagnate, but when compared to inflation, actually declining over his tenure. And, you know, working people still struggling and still, you know, fighting just to make ends meet.
Yeah, I would say a couple things. I mean, one, so President Trump inherited an economy that had been steadily recovering for about 7 years before he took the reins. The fact that in his first year and a half, he didn't manage to completely derail it is sort of congratulations so far, but we'll see. Two, I would say even I'm a little surprised that there hasn't been more upward pressure on wages, given that unemployment has now been relatively low for a while now. I think part of the reason why we have not seen that wage growth is because we've spent the past couple of decades trying to kick out anything that supported bargaining power or leverage for most workers in this economy. And so we now need just white hot labor markets before workers feel empowered at all to get anything. And that sort of long run structural decline in the things that can support workers' wages, we know Trump is and his administration are just working overtime to reinforce those. Right. With all the rules he's made, the Supreme Court decision, it took away public sector employees' ability. Didn't take it away, but made it much harder for public sector employees to organize. So I think in terms of that long-run effect on American wages, the actions of the Trump administration so far have just been unambiguously bad. And even a 4% unemployment rate, which he largely inherited, hasn't been enough to make up for that and push wages up.
Now you study this stuff, and this is your world. Can we now at some point say that these myths that we've been fed, force-fed for 40 years, like tax cuts create jobs and you know, the invisible hand will rise wages and a tight labor pool is going to raise wages. Can we officially at some point say that that's bunk, that, you know, they're dead, and let's kill them off and say, look, the only way that wage increases happen is when workers demand and have the power to demand higher wages?
Yeah, I think that's largely right. I mean, I think what we now know, and even now, I would say, a much wider group of people know this now, like economists who 10 years ago would have been very skeptical about, you know, saying I like unions. They now realize that a key reason why wage growth has been so flat, even when unemployment is low, or even when other indicators say wage growth should be going okay, is exactly the decline in workers' leverage and power. And the number one thing that gives workers leverage and power is the ability to form a union. I think other measures as well, you know, other policy issues as well. We have a federal minimum wage today that is still about 25% lower than it was than in inflation-adjusted terms in the late 1960s, even as the economy's productivity has gone up about 80%, even as low-wage workers are much more educated and experienced. So between unionization, between just savaging the federal minimum wage, between allowing unemployment to sit too long in the name of fighting phantom inflation, you know, all this in the end shouldn't be a surprise. We've basically had policymakers trying hard for 40 years to keep wage growth from happening, and they've succeeded. If we want that to reverse, we need very different policies and probably different policymakers.
Yeah, you could break out the Bush banner, mission accomplished. They've done exactly what they wanted to do. And you make an interesting point. I mean, you know, I've been saying for a long time, it comes down to the policies that we've pushed. And over the last 40 years, it's been all anti-worker policies. Here in Pennsylvania this week, what we saw were a whole bunch of anti-worker pieces of legislation moving through the legislature, even though they don't have a snowball's chance of passing. It's still this constant attack, this constant drumbeat on prevailing wage, on workers' compensation, on unemployment, on, you know, you name it, the entire no rights at work agenda front and center as Republicans. And I hate to be this partisan, but it's the Republicans who are pushing this agenda.
That's right. I mean, I would say for way too long, Republicans pushed that agenda really hard and Democrats did not push back. A good friend of mine, Jared Bernstein, an economist, he has the line of, if only Democrats liked unions as much as Republicans hated them, we may have actually made some headway in protecting them over the past couple of decades, but we didn't. You had the Republicans who hated them and tried to crush them and Democrats who were not that in love with them. Luckily, I think some of that is turning around. I think lots of people, mostly Democrats, are realizing the importance of unionization for actually boosting living standards for most people. Hopefully, it's not too late in the game, but it's pretty late in the game. But I think for too long, like you said, it was a Republican push that didn't have a strong enough pushback. Hopefully, we can rally and get that pushback going.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much bad that you hope at some point that things turn the corner, because you're right. I mean, right now, people are looking to unions going, okay, now how do we fix what's been screwed up for the last 40 years at a time when unions have basically been hobbled?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's never too late to start trying to do the right thing on policy, but I'd much rather be starting from a position where we had not allowed just decades of attacks on workers' right to organize to have really settled in. I mean, I think policies matter a ton. If you look at, a lot of people want to blame stuff like globalization or technology for why unions are no longer, you know, all that powerful in the U.S. economy. And you look at other countries like Canada, Germany, that have been exposed to the same forces of globalization, sometimes even more exposed in terms of smaller countries like Canada. You know, they have computers in Canada, and yet they also have much higher rates of union density. And what explains the difference is political choices. And so if we make different political choices, we actually can have a more empowered working class in the United States. And I think people now realize wage growth, it's not just about the intersection of supply and demand curves. It's about the power and leverage that workers bring to the labor market. And we need to start doing everything we can to restore that.
No, you're absolutely right. And I look at the Kavanaugh nomination as one of those moments where, you know, there's actually a possibility of repealing most of the policies of the 20th century through court decisions that will come. Because, you know, I point to the National Labor Relations Act. The original writing of the act gave employers absolutely no rights because they understood the employers had all the rights. What it did is it gave employees a little bit of leverage to say, hey, you know what, we're going to band together. We're going to form and join unions to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and conditions. And guess what? It worked really well. We took a poverty class of my grandparents' generation, and they led solidly middle-class lives. They wanted for nothing, and they retired with a bit of dignity and security. And now with the assault on unions the last 40 years, we're looking into a retirement crisis that's going to smack us right in the face here in the next couple of years.
I think your point on the Supreme Court is really, really key. I think it's an underappreciated part of, you know, obviously the Supreme Court is incredibly powerful across a wide range of issues, and all of them are important. But the economic content of their decisions has been really underappreciated. And in just this last term, you saw it, you know, on the one hand, there's the case in Janus where the Supreme Court made organizing public sector employees much, much harder. And then another case that they basically said employers have the right to force their workers to sign away their rights to engage in class action lawsuits. So if you work for a firm that systematically discriminates against women or people of color, You have signed something your first day on the job. You didn't even know it, but you signed it that said, I'm not going to go to the courts. I cannot join a class action. I have to go to a private arbitrator who has this close relationship with the employer, and that's the only access to justice I have. It was a huge issue, this mandatory arbitration, this waiving of rights to do class action suits. Didn't get commented on enough, but it's exactly the kind of decision the Supreme Court makes. And a really interesting thing in that decision was Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dissent, which the whole preamble was about what you just said, the National Labor Relations Act, and just the we have labor laws because we take it for granted that it is an uneven playing field when an individual worker tries to bargain with a corporation. In order to level that playing field, we need to use labor law and regulations to actually give them some rights and to really level that playing field. And I think that's an insight that's been lost, it's been attacked, and it's going to be continue to be attacked as long as the Supreme Court is dominated by people with this conservative view of economics.
No, you're absolutely right. And, again, the Epic System cases is one of the ones you were talking about. And, it's not just day one of employment. I actually had listeners to our radio program, contact me and say, look, I was on a job 20 years. My employer came in and said, sign this or there's the door. And, they had no recourse other than to sign their constitutional right to access the courts away, or they were going to be fired on the spot.
Yeah, the only, looking for silver linings, I would say the only silver lining with the Epic Systems case is it can be fixed by Congress. Some of the Supreme Court cases will require another Supreme Court decision to overturn. The Epic Systems case can be overturned by legislation. Congress can just pass a law saying employers are not allowed to do this. I think there's, if there is a different Congress in either the House of Representatives or Senate come November and January, there will likely be legislation introduced to try to overturn that case and say employers are not allowed to force their workers to do this. And that's one of those small issues. It sounds small. It's not a small issue, but it's one of those under the radar issues when there's dozens of them that add up that have just sapped so much bargaining power from American workers. And it's going to require a concentrated assault from progressive forces to roll all of that back. And so I would urge people to, keep an eye on that one. Keep an eye on a bill that will sort of roll back the right of employers to force mandatory arbitration and the waiving of class action suits. I think it could be something we see early if there is a different Congress.
Well, I hope so. I mean, at the end of the day, to me, this is the first step towards bringing back yellow dog contracts and signing all of your rights away, whether it's to sue or to join a union or, to minimum wage or, whatever. I mean, when you look at what they've done thus far, the future is, extremely unstable.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, after 40 years of going after sort of every source of leverage that low and middle wage workers have, the other side has had to get really obvious in what they're trying to do. For years, it was sort of like staff the NLRB with people who are just going to give decisions unfavorable to employees. Now they just flat out allow employers to do stuff like sign away your rights to mandatory arbitration or non-compete clauses for if you leave me as an employee, you're not allowed to work for anyone else in my industry. You sign a non-compete clause. There was a time when non-compete clauses were mostly for really privileged workers. The idea was like, oh, they know my trade secrets, and so it makes some sense. Now they try to make fast food workers sign non-compete clauses. And so I feel like after 40 years of going after every margin of worker power, they're now going way out in the open because that's the only thing left. Really bald, incredibly obvious attacks, and hopefully it sparks a backlash. The backlash is overdue.
No, I'm with you. But again, they don't want to let out what's in the secret sauce.
Yeah, it's true. I think that's their dilemma. It's like the only things left to attack is going to be really obvious, but we can't help ourselves.
And again, at some point, I'm hoping at the ballot box, working people get fed up and say enough is enough already as we continue to lay out the absurdity of the conservative economic arguments that we see, play out for the last 40 years. And none of them yet have come to fruition. I grew up during the Reagan years. And I remember, the whole trickle down thing. It was going to be great. We were going to give rich people so much money that their pockets would eventually overflow and it would rain down on us like rivers of gold and honey.
That is the theory. And that was the exact, it was a complete reboot of that theory that was used to sell the Tax Cut and Jobs Act that passed at the end of 2017.
They tried to sell that? I thought they just rammed that down our throats.
That's a good question. I think they tried to sell it. That $4,000 wage increase figure, that was pretty classic supply side. It was like, you give corporations more money, you let them keep more of their profits, and they'll invest more. They'll invest in more factories and equipment. Like, the real problem with the U.S. economy over the past couple of years has been profit rates are too low. You know, when I look at the data, profit rates, I see them being historically high. And so the idea that that was the problem with the U.S. economy was really odd, but that was the supply side playbook. And that's what they tried to sell. I think luckily this time, not many people bought it, but it did get rammed through.
And last question I've got for you, because, you know, ultimately this is going to be a policy fight. You know, at some point we've got to be talking about raising tax rates on the very wealthy and bringing more revenue into our government, and also an updated version of labor laws. I mean, you know, 80 years of ossified labor laws is actually being used against working people. You guys have an agenda that you're kind of pushing to help raise wages and make folks, you know, rebuild the working class, a prosperous working class. I hate to use the frame middle class, but to help rebuild a prosperous working class.
Yeah, we do. We call it the first day fairness agenda. And it's the idea that somebody's first day on the job shouldn't be one where they just sign away so many of the rights that could actually allow them to get wage increases. And so we talked about mandatory arbitration. That's something people sign the first day on the job. We think somebody's first day on the job, they should be signing their union membership card. We think the first day on the job, there should be access to things like paid sick leave and paid family leave, so that a couple months down the road, a family crisis isn't going to force them to choose between keeping their job or being able to care for a loved one. We think the first day on the job, there should be a reasonable federal minimum wage that can actually, you know, have a family out of poverty. And so if you go to our website, epi.org, and look for First Day Fairness, we've got like 15 items in total. And it's basically things that should just be taken for granted in the employment relationship. Just basic rights and standards that we should take for granted, but have been completely eroded by the conservative assault, and we should rebuild some of them and then introduce new rights that we never managed to achieve, like paid sick leave. So look for our First Day Fairness agenda. I think it's powerful stuff to actually rebuild some power for workers.
No, it's fantastic stuff, and I'd love you to come back and share and talk about it. But again, you know, that take it for granted, like my grandparents' generation took for granted that, you know, they were passing on to their children, better wages, opportunities, you know, the 8-hour day, healthcare, pensions, defined benefit pensions, none of those crappy 401ks. That's the kind of things I'd like to take for granted once again. But Josh, I appreciate the time. Great stuff.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff, Josh Bivens. He's the director of research there at the Economic Policy Institute, epi.org. Lots of good stuff there. Take a quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1932. That was the day the state militia was called into Kincaid, Illinois. 164 high school students had just walked out of the classroom, declaring themselves on strike. They were protesting the school board's use of coal from the Peabody Coal Company. The students walked out in solidarity with their fathers, who were on strike against the Peabody coal mine in nearby Langleyville over wage concessions. The father-son strike, as it was referred to, was one more in a series of protest actions that came on the heels of the founding of the Progressive Miners of America a month earlier. Thousands of Illinois miners had just voted with their feet to repudiate John L. Lewis's UMWA over wage concessions. After their founding conference, new PMA leaders began aggressively organizing non-union mines. They marched into mining towns and ordered non-union diggers out of the mines. They also struck UMWA mines picketing against the industry standard of $5 a day that had been set by the latest concessionary contract. At some mines, the PMA was able to win the old $6.10 a day wage. Throughout the month, the State National Guard had been called out to a number of mining towns to quell armed conflicts between PMA and UMWA supporters. The Peabody coal mine in Langleyville had been shut down for months by ongoing PMA-UMWA conflict. Now it had reopened under heavy National Guard protection and was the only mine operating in Christian County. The striking fathers were PMA miners picketing the continued mine operations under the UMWA concessionary contract. The years-long Illinois mine wars had just begun. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. So this week, Eric Schmidt, he tweeted out what I thought was kind of an interesting tweet. He said, let's find ideas that can increase the wages of 100,000 low and moderate income workers by at least 10 grand. Delighted, he tweets, to support calls for ideas for a unicorn for the middle class. And then he puts JFF's $1 billion wage gain challenge. Now, JFF is the group Jobs for the Future. And they've put out this idea that, you know what, we need some ideas on how to increase wages, which have been stagnant for 40 years. And the thing is here's a guy who, you know, Eric Schmidt, here's a guy who's worth about $14 billion asking how we can find, quote, a unicorn for the middle class. You know, and my first thoughts, a couple of observations. First, if it means so much that we do this, that we increase the wages of low and moderate wage workers, where were you while you were the chairman and head of Google and Alphabet Incorporated? Where were you when you were the CEO, when you were the top dog? Where were you in the boardrooms calling for better wages for your workforce? Where were you in the union organizing drive for the bus drivers who move your really brilliant scientists and computer software guys all around? Where were you then? Answer, really nowhere. And then, you know, the other part of this is, you know, where were you politically? Where were you in the world of pushing for policies that would have allowed workers to join and form unions? Where were you then? Because the answer to this question is really very simple. Stop all of the anti-worker abuse. Stop all the legislation. Any politician who brings up gutting wages, destroying conditions, changing maximum hour laws or minimum wage laws, any of these preemption laws, basically anything the Republican-led House of Representatives in Pennsylvania did this week, all of them should be out of office. All of them should be looking for the crummy jobs that they want to create. Now, for those of us in the working world, a unicorn is a mythical creature that kids imagine, but they never actually see. I would, again, prefer something better for workers, something tangible, better wages, hours, conditions that, oh, by the way, unions fight for and have fought for. To me, if Eric Schmidt is really sincere in this, there is one policy. Go back and undo all of the bad attacks on the National Labor Relations Act. Give workers the ability to have a seat at the table and not just a place on the menu. We've seen this movie before. And look, you know, I'm not saying it's going to work out exactly as it did, but we're heading towards a time where almost every working person I talk to, they're struggling. They're struggling mightily. There are things that we should be doing hugely on the policy front. Now, Jobs for the Future is asking, you know, how can you translate this system? How can we transform wage stagnation into wage gains? That's basically this thing. In fact, they kicked it off on the 24th of September, and they are asking for submissions. They write wage stagnation, flatlining, and falling wages for low and income workers over the past 40 years is a national crisis. Absolutely agree. The costs and causes of wage stagnation will take short and long-term solutions to fix. Reversing wage stagnation is a domestic moonshot of our generation. Again, agree. They've, like I said, they've moved and launched this $1 billion wage gain challenge to raise the wages, as Schmidt said, of 100,000 workers by 10 grand by 2021. And again, they're taking these submissions and they want ideas. And I think it's a great thing to have and begin the conversation. But at the end of the day, there is one, in my view, that works better than all. And that's give people the power at their workplace to share in the wealth that their labor creates. Sit down across from the table from the boss who, you know, a CEO like Eric Schmidt, $14 billion he's worth? Is he really going to have the authority or the ability to say, sorry, yeah, I know I'm worth $14 billion and I know our CEO salary is off the charts, but we really can't afford that nickel raise. You know, here's a new magic marker. Or, oh, hey, a nameplate. You can put it right there on your jacket. And it looks really sharp. So they're asking for ideas on how to use existing ideas to scale up. And I love that. We're going to scale up wages and jobs. They also want experimental ideas that they can move into the pilot frame. They push a lot of education, you know, the idea of, you know, we need to educate workers. We need job training, you know, more internships, accelerated job training, you know, job sharing stuff. These are the kind of ideas that they're pushing around. Me personally, here's an idea. How about paying a living wage? How about mandating that all employees, if you work in this country, if you go and you punch the clock and you do what's expected of you, if you work hard, you play by the rules, that you do okay and you get ahead, maybe with health care, maybe with retirement, maybe some of that stuff. They also want to look at the structure of work and how people are being compensated. One of the things I agree with that they talk about is ending misclassification. This idea of we're going to have W-9 employees instead of W-2 employees. People who are their own boss, yet wear the other company's uniform and adhere to all of the rules and regulations and are, you know, told where to go, what to do, how to do it, why to do it, when to do it, all of that. But yet, they're their own boss. they also talk about stable scheduling, which I'm all 100% in favor of. Another part that they're looking at is worker agency, you know, and voice on the job. And ownership, all things that I think are good. The idea of co-ops, the idea of stock incentives, organizing, all of that stuff combined to create an opportunity for workers to engage in some form of alternative collective bargaining. You know, if you're the owner of the company, you know, there are a lot of co-ops out there that are co-op in name only, where the employees don't really have a say. They get like one voice, one vote, and the CEO gets like 100. That's not a true co-op. I'm of the mindset I would love to see, you know, groups of workers joining together and owning the factors of production and sharing equally the wealth that their labor creates, and also pulling down the CEO wage, which, and I'm not being envious here. It's out of whack. You know, the fact that during the 1960s, a CEO made about 20 times what the average worker on the shop floor made because we had strong unions and because those CEOs had to sit across the table from those workers. They made a lot of money. They still did well, but not like today where you're looking at the average CEOs, you know, somewhere 300 times what the average worker makes. And in some places, like the one company, the one toy company, the woman made like, you know, 9,000 times what the average worker makes. It's insane. It's out of hand, it's out of control, and at some point, you've got to look at this and say, from a policy standpoint, you know, what do we do? From a policy standpoint, how do we encourage people to join and form unions? Look, the polling is off the charts. Right now, unions are in. People are going, yeah, we need that voice again. In fact, I've talked to Republicans who have said, you know, we've been sold the anti-union stuff, but I look at, you know, people who are in unions, and I look at the fact that they make a good wage. They have really, really good health care. They've got defined benefit pensions still, or at least good 401ks that are well managed. And they have some seniority, some security on the job, where they're not just at will and fired willy-nilly for anything. And they're starting to see that and going, wow, well, that's maybe not a bad deal. Maybe that's what we need. Now, as the Jobs for the Future points out, there's an imbalance in the power in the labor market. There really is. The pendulum, as I've said a number of times, has swung way to the side of the employer class. How do you bring that back? How do you reverse 40 years of anti-worker assaults? How do you undo all of the things that Republicans have done and Democrats have allowed them to do? And I think Josh Bivens hit it on the head. You know, I wish Democrats were as strongly in favor of unions as Republicans are in their hatred of them. Because Republicans understand it's power. And it's power to not just have better wages, hours, and conditions for workers and their families, but also power politically to push for strong policies like a higher minimum wage, like access to health insurance, like access to paid family leave. You know, a whole bunch of things that we should be doing, paid sick leave, ensuring that people don't get fired for stupid reasons, ensuring that when someone goes off to fight in the war or they go off to serve their country in one form or another, that their job is there when they get back. There are so many things that we should be pushing for. But what's happening is we're being pushed down a path towards desperation, towards poverty wages, and backwards. You know, I keep saying that we, the policy that the Republicans want and the policies that I fear a Supreme Court, that a conservative court brings us, is back to the 80s and not the 1980s. Back to the 1880s era of desperation, of company stores, of company script, of the boss being in charge of everything about your life. You know, a lot of people talk about Henry Ford, and I love the Henry Ford story. You know, Henry Ford was a visionary. Henry Ford, you know, doubled his workers' wages, $5 a day, because he wanted them to buy his automobiles, which is true. But to get to that wage, the workers had to submit to a code of ethics, to a moral code. And the, you know, the Ford goons would come and inspect. Surprise inspections on your home to see if you were leading, well, a good Christian life. And it's interesting to me that we picked that one part of it, but the other one not so much. So the question is how do we as a country move forward on policies that are going to make workers' lives better? Because we're told, and I believe this, that everyone should work. I believe there's a therapeutic quality of work. I believe there's something in getting up and knowing that you have something to do and a job accomplished and the ability to make one's own way, the ability to earn a reasonable living and to be able to exist in some bit of comfort and leisure. I'm not talking about pure equality where I get to be Donald Trump and grab women by the you-know-what and, you know, fly around on private jets and yachts and all that. But I'm talking about being able to take a day off occasionally to play with the kids. You know, maybe, you know, a reasonably new car. Maybe the ability to take a vacation. Oh, I don't know. Maybe when I get sick and have to go to the doctor, it doesn't bankrupt me. You know, the latest Kaiser Foundation survey just came out. The number one thing that working people are worried about, unexpected medical costs. A $400 unexpected medical cost could basically throw, well, I think the number was like 50% of the folks in this country into financial chaos. And the more you look at the policies we're not pursuing, and this is the real troublesome part, the harder it is for working families to exist. And the more we're allowing employers to use gig employees or their own boss independent contractors who they've misclassified, and the more we see Supreme Court decisions like the Epic Systems cases that take your rights away, the more you see families in chaos. The more you see, and we're going to continue to see, the anger of a working class that is working really hard. American workers are the hardest workers in the world. But they're struggling to get by. And at the end of the day, the only way we turn this ship around, the only way we create that prosperous working class of the past, you know it, by allowing them to join and form unions. To me, that simple. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. What do you think? Is it possible for something outside of collective bargaining and outside of union-friendly policies? Do you think it's possible to raise the wages of 100,000 workers by 10 grand over the next couple of years? Do you think that's possible? Or do you think this is a benevolent dictator saying, you know, we can do that even if I take it out of my own pocket to make it look like we've done something? I'm curious your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. A new report out by the National Institute on Retirement Security highlights what I think we all already know. And that's quite simply the concept of retirement may be dead for the majority of Americans thanks to bad policy, corporate theft, the destruction of the defined benefit plan, numerous stock market crashes and corrections, and really just plain poverty wage jobs. National Institute on Retirement Security Executive Director Diane Oakley said in a report recently that the American dream of a modest retirement after a lifetime of work is now a middle-class nightmare. Now, I would argue it's a working-class nightmare. I've always said we need to get away from this idea of only middle-class people expecting to have retirement or reasonable wage jobs. This is a working-class issue. The reality, if you look at the numbers in this study, are scary beyond belief. They claim in this report that nearly 4 out of 5 working Americans are falling short of even the most conservative retirement savings targets. Roughly the same 4 out of 5 have less than 1 year of income in any retirement account. This is the part that just, wow, nearly 3 out of 5. Have less than 1 year, that number of, you know, the less than 1 year, the 4 out of 5 that have 3 of those have nothing, have close to absolutely nothing. The report says 57% or more than 100 million working age Americans do not own any retirement account assets at all. Nothing in an employer-sponsored 401k plan, no IRA, no pension, nothing. In the alert, the National Institute on Retirement Security says while the typical American needs 85% of their income while working to retire on to maintain their standard of living, Social Security only provides somewhere around 35%. That leaves a massive gap. Now, what they're saying is to help fill the retirement savings gap, the retirement security think tank says that, you know what? What we need to be doing? Expanding Social Security. What we need to be doing is opening up opportunities for employers to buy into low-cost, high-quality defined contribution plans, defined benefit pension plans, or even hybrid plans. The idea that from a policy perspective, we actually do something, I think is really important. I like the idea of what they're doing in California with CalPERS, allowing small businesses to buy into savings plans, pension plans for their workforce. It does a couple of things. One, it helps shore up the pension plan for the state employees and for everybody and lowers the risk. And it gives people who work for small business access to retirement accounts and professionals and people who are not going to cheat them and rob them blind. The problem with our retirement security is that we've given it to Wall Street in a lot of the cases, and they have robbed us blind. So for me, the idea of opening up access to state pension plans and getting more people into them is a good idea. And the idea of expanding Social Security, especially at a time when Republicans are saying, no, we need to end it. We need to cut. We need to destroy the entitlements. I'm telling you. Lots to do and the crisis on the horizon. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you next week.